This is Technically Speaking, your weekly source for all things that can run on batteries. Today is Monday, July 27th, 2015. Today on the show, keeping your email from going dormant, extending your Wi-Fi, and doing more with your phone. All that and more coming up. This is Technically Speaking, the weekly dose of technology discussion and listener questions here on UConn's own 91.7 WHUS stores. I'm Drew Gates. I'm a technology enthusiast and broadcaster here at WHUS.
I'm Jason McMullen. I'm a broadcaster at WHUS, and I've been building and fixing computers for too many years.
My name is Mike Fagan, otherwise known as Doc Teef, here at WHUS. I'm a broadcaster, but also a graduate student in the computer science department here at the University of Connecticut. We're taking your questions at 860-880-0119. Leave us a voicemail and hear your question on air. You can also email us at ask@wespeaktech.org or tweet us at WHUSTech. We're going to start off with a few listener questions today. The first one here is paraphrased from a Blue Arrow comment, it would appear. Can you recommend a free email account provider to use as a backup to my Gmail account? I've had two accounts deleted from Gmail for what they claimed were terms of service violations, but I think they were just because I wasn't logging in often enough. There wasn't anything I absolutely needed, but I had a lot of accounts using that email address, and now I don't have it. Is there a provider I can set up an account with that won't delete my account if it's not used for a certain amount of time? I don't want to lose another email address. I'm willing to use one that charges a small fee if necessary. Thanks. So guys, any initial thoughts?
Well, Jason and I talked a bit about this before you came in, Mike. Mm-hmm. I think that my solution, which isn't necessarily the best solution, but it is a possible solution, was for the listener to register a domain that his email address is going to be at. It's going to cost him, you know, $10, $15 a year or so to maintain it. And use an email address at that domain. That way, it doesn't matter what email host he's using. Mm-hmm. He'll always have that email address in the future, as long as he keeps paying that fee. He can also, you know, prepay it for up to 10 years at a time to make sure he doesn't have to think about it. And if he doesn't log in or think about it for a decade, it'll still be there.
I think that's a pretty good option to think about. I was wondering what the Gmail terms actually are, because I've got Gmail accounts I've been using for years. And I looked it up, and I couldn't find an actual link in their product terms, but I did find a few forum posts that basically seem to say that the term was an inactive account. An account would be considered inactive and would be eligible for suspension or deletion if there was no activity on the account for 8 months. But the understanding from users was that the 8-month term was not typically applied except to brand new accounts. So if somebody created an account and then just didn't use it at all for 8 months, it would sometimes be deleted. But if there was a bunch of stuff associated with it, say there was a bunch of mail in the inboxes in the archive, that they tended to be much more lenient than the 8-month term that was actually there in their terms of use.
Gotcha.
So obviously Gmail is not the best option if you're planning to not log in for an extended period of time. It is also possible that in our particular case here that there were some terms of service violations. We don't know exactly what was going on here, but I almost tend to think that maybe someone else, a malicious actor, compromised the email account, or maybe they were doing some things with it they shouldn't have been doing. That seems more likely, unless, you know, you're going to Australia for 2 years and you're not going to have internet access while you're doing that or whatever.
Yeah, that was my thought as well. It seems that as far as I knew, it takes a long time for your Gmail, especially one that's been used, to get deleted. And that seems to be the case from what you found, Jason. So my first thought was maybe, yeah, some sort of malicious actor, maybe your account was sending spam or something like that, and that resulted them deleting the account. Maybe too many spam identifications or something like that.
Yeah, so you always want to sort of keep an eye on what your account's being used for. Don't share your account passwords with anybody. Make sure it's a long, unique password, all that stuff we always say. And in terms of if you want to make sure that you have locked down access to an email account, that you'll be able to get it back if you need it, I think Drew's suggestion is probably the best way to do that. It's a little bit technical, but if you own the domain, you not only own your name at the domain, you own every other possible email address at the domain, yeah. Which doesn't mean you're going to get every single piece of mail. That's going to require that you set up more things and have that mail be going somewhere. Again, this is not a great solution if you're planning to just disappear for a number of years and not be on the internet. But you'll at least be able to get the name back when you come back out of the woods.
There are also domain registrars that provide a free email account as part of your registration. So looking at something like that might, I you know, can't speak to individual registrars as to how long they'll let a dormant email account retain its mail. But that seems like a plausible place to look. And then there are also just another, if you just set up most registrars will also let you just forward email addresses at a domain to any account you want. So just create an account at a free service that's not Gmail, if that's the one you've been having problems with, and just forward all of your email there.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. And I think there may be some kind of a business opportunity here, because I don't know if anybody's doing it now, but they've been telling us since sometime in the 70s that, like, cryogenic stasis for people with terrible injuries or incurable diseases is going to be part of the future. And obviously, if you're planning to go into some form of cryogenic stasis or have your brain frozen after you die or whatever, you're also going to want to set up a way to keep getting email and have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of email messages waiting for you when you wake up in the future, because that's what we all want to do when we get to the future, is read email for years.
So I've got thousands of years of spam to read.
Someone needs to figure out how to get an email service to just automatically store all of the emails into, like, Amazon's Glacier
system. Nah, man, you just start a service that you get you buy a cave somewhere, and people hire you to print their emails off, and you just store them in boxes in the cave. And so if they need an email, you can get them a physical copy of it.
But papers degrade. I don't think a cave
caves is actually the best condition for paper. I was just seeing,
because they're damp.
Cause it's dark. It's really the light that's what kills paper. The paper being damp isn't so bad. Especially if you have it properly protected in, like, Mylar or some sort of kind of plastic.
Well, now you're getting more complicated than just sticking it in a cave, which was your original suggestion.
Well, there could be like a premium.
Now I need Mylar.
There could be a premium level of service where
you store that.
Where you etch it into stone tablets.
I think that's a better solution. Etch it into the walls of the cave.
Parchment, thick parchment.
Honestly, I sort of feel like, and this is maybe me being short-sighted and not understanding some people's actual situations, but I feel like if you're not using email for months or years at a time, why not just not have an email address and then recreate it when you come back to the internet? Like,
yeah.
Just port your phone number to Google Voice and leave it there.
All right, so I think we've sort of we've done all we can do on that one. I hope that was helpful. That you're listening to Technically Speaking on WHUS.org 91.7. If you have a question, you can get in touch with us 860-880-0119, email ask@wespeaktech.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @WHUSTech.
All right, so Jack from Windsor wrote in, I have a wireless router next to my computer. It works fine in most of my house, but it does not work in the room farthest from where the computer and router are. What can I do to remedy this?
So there are widely available products that are called Wi-Fi range extenders. This is a fairly mature category of products. I found what I think is a pretty good write-up on this that was published in the Wirecutter. Earlier this year, in May of this year. And we'll send that out on the WHUS Tech Twitter. If anybody's interested, they can go review it. But essentially, basically what this device is going to do is it's going to function as an extra hotspot that will take over at the end of the house or the end of the office where you're not getting good coverage from your primary router. Other things you could play around with before you look into buying an additional device would be to move the router. If it's possible for you to physically move the router without screwing up your other installations, you might be able to move it to a more central location, possibly get enough signal in the part of the house where you weren't getting it before that it will work. But if we assume that that's off the table, either because you don't want to move it or you can't move it, these Wi-Fi range extenders will typically work, and what they will do is they will pair wirelessly with your primary router, and then they'll set up a second network. And that second network will be centered wherever you physically place the new Wi-Fi extender. And is assuming your devices have the ability to hold multiple multiple network settings inside their memory, they should be able to move from one to the other, and you should be all set. Let's see. I'm looking at price ranges here. I think you can get decent ones for around $25, $35, and they go up, as almost everything in tech does, they go up to the point where you're really buying more than you need, probably, which would be in excess of $100.
Yeah, I've been using a Wi-Fi extender, not at home, but actually at work for the past 8 months or so. And it works pretty well. We have a budget one. I think it was $40 or $50 when we got it. And I do notice a speed decrease when using the extended network versus when using the initial network. But it's definitely still usable. And it bumped when we put it in. I put it in actually like right on the other side of a concrete wall from the router. So it was just enough to get it through the wall, and then it bounces it to the rest of the area I needed to cover pretty well.
Yeah, I would expect there to be a speed decrease with that because, you know, it's another bottleneck in the line. But yeah, I think Jason's suggestion that if you can move the router, that's a good call because it's going to save you money and, you know, again, that speed decrease that you have with the, you know, extension and all that. Plus, you know, a wire, the router extension is also another point of failure. So I assume you'd probably want to have one router if you can. But of course, if you need the extender, that's a different story. So, I think that's a pretty good analysis of that one.
If you want to get geeky on this subject, it is actually possible to go for much more complex and sort of interesting systems.
I also have a quick suggestion. You could also get a more powerful router.
That was what I was going to pop in.
If your router is older or, you know, underpowered, maybe a less expensive model, you could, instead of investing in the extender, just invest in a more expensive router that will have a bigger range. You know, you can do research on routers that have good ranges in that regard. And then in doing that, you'll spend some more money, same thing as with the extender, but in spending that money, you'll also probably get a better all-around unit in other ways as well. Maybe better security, maybe better hardware, maybe whatever.
And probably one that's going to last you a few years longer than the setup of using an older router and just adding an extender would.
Agreed.
Yeah, that's a good call. And then the other thing I wanted to touch on here, not that I'm enough of an expert to give you a real answer on this, but there is a whole second category of wireless networking, which is done by network engineers who are doing setups for like businesses and big office environments and things like that, where they're having to cover, say, a huge facility or even an entire building or whatever. And what they will do is they will do a bunch of sort of site analysis stuff. They'll go out and gather data, and then they will design a system which will have a whole bunch of access points that are designed to work in sync with each other and not generate too much interference for each other, and try to seamlessly pass connections without disrupting the flow of data as devices move from access point to access point to access point. It's one of these little nerdy things that exists in the world, and there's a market for it, and there are people who have a great deal of expertise. But it's not the kind of thing you run across on a daily basis. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, the Wi-Fi and things like big apartment buildings and big offices, office buildings with lots of small offices in them, tend to not work very well, because they have a ton of different wireless networks that are all competing for the same small pool of bandwidth. Mm-hmm. And none of them are designed to work in sync with each other or to share the space gracefully.
Yeah, scaling up Wi-Fi is a harder task than it would seem, especially in a dense environment like that. I can attest just from the kind of classes I've taken at UConn, you know, that's a whole area of research, is how to keep Wi-Fi signals from interfering with each other.
So we have a call here, and I'm going to bring it up for you now. This is, I think I have a note here that says this is Kathy from Chester. So we're going to check out the call right now, and then we'll respond.
Hi, my name's Kathy, and I'm calling from Cheshire. I'm having some issues with my phone. My phone will charge when I plug it into my computer, but I can't seem to download data to it. Is there something special I have to do? I have a Galaxy S3 and an HP Touch Smart 610, and I have the same problem with both. Thanks for the help.
All right, so I'm just going to jump right in here and say that I think that if your phone will charge, but you're not able to copy data to it, same with your tablet, the most likely scenario is that you're using a USB cable that only supports power, that doesn't have those data wires in it to connect the computer to the phone. I think that if you find a cable that supports data, there's a good chance that will probably just solve your problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good call, and it's certainly the first thing to check. Many USB cables, in some cases even the ones that came with your phone, will be charge only or power only. And they can be considered to be a security benefit as well, because they will allow you to plug into foreign devices and get power without offering up your device for a possible compromise of some kind. But there is a whole other thing that comes up when you're trying to plug in your Android devices and really smart devices in general and access the storage, in that many of them have a security feature enabled, and they keep moving it around and changing how you turn this on. But basically, there's a security feature enabled which hides the storage and hides all the data on the device, because they want you to explicitly authorize it before someone gets access to any writable storage on your device, or even readable. They don't want people to go in and steal your pictures without you authorizing it from the device.
So that's usually an option that you can find in settings, or it may be something that comes up case by case when the phone's plugged in. You'll get a prompt in your notification screen to switch into mass storage mode.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. It often will pop up as a notification in Android saying USB connected, and then you have to click on that notification. It'll take you to a place where you can say yes, connect USB storage. Later versions of Android, you may have to click down through and find something called USB utilities, which will be under the more menu in your Android settings. And then you have to, again, authorize it. It's basically you're doing the same thing. I've seen a couple of phones from carriers where it was a standalone app that you had to turn on, and then that would allow you to access the USB storage through a computer. But you basically had to figure out what they wanted to call it when they were making this Sprint phone or Verizon phone or whatever, and then activate that particular application, and that would allow you to throw up a switch and then say yes, you want to access your storage on the device.
Mike, you have an S3, right?
Yes.
All right, so does yours have the keys apps, like keys?
Yeah, I've never used it, but it does.
So some of the Samsung phones, at least the Galaxy S3, I don't know if any of the other ones include this, have an app called Keys Air that when you enable it, basically opens up a web server on your phones, so that you can go into your web browser on your computer and you can upload and download photos and files and contacts, and I think you can like send text messages through it. I had
that on the Galaxy S2 back when I had one of those, and it was labeled, it was Keys. Yeah, it was K-I-E-S, and it was just another app, and I was like, what the heck is this thing? And it wouldn't let you uninstall it like so much of the Samsung stuff. And then it did actually have a function, which I figured out eventually. But
and it was actually a, you know, borderline useful function.
This is true. I think in order to use the Wi-Fi hotspot functionality, I had to turn on the same thing or a similar thing on one phone that I had. But anyway, that's hopefully enough for you to find it. Thank you very much for the call, listener. And the other device that she mentions there is, I believe, the computer that she was trying to connect the phone to. The HP Touch Smart 610 should be a computer, not a phone, I believe. So hopefully that is... And the computer, it shouldn't really matter. Assuming it's running a modern operating system, everything should be handled on the phone side, and the computer should be able to see that as a device and then allow you to move files over and do whatever else you need to do. The other thing you can do if you're trying to migrate files into and out of your device is use something like a syncing service. Dropbox has mobile apps for almost all platforms. I don't know if they have them for Windows Phone. And also Google Drive are both reasonable options if you're comfortable using a third party for this. You can use something like BitTorrent Sync, which we're not recommending as much as we used to because they've gone through some changes. But there are other ways to just use the fact that your device is connected to the internet to move files on and off of your device from your desktop system.
Yeah, BitTorrent Sync is a shame. I don't use it much anymore ever since they've changed everything around.
All right, but in the next few weeks, watch for a review of Sync Thing, which is an open source alternative to BitTorrent Sync that I've been messing around with. So after I do a little bit more testing, I haven't thrown a ton of data at it yet to see how it handles it, but I'm planning on trying that this weekend. If all goes well, then we'll have probably hopefully a positive review of it.
Very nice. So I look forward to that because I've been looking for a replacement myself.
So this is an open source alternative. Do you know what license it's under?
I can tell you in about 3 seconds.
All right. I will dance around here on the mic until that happens. You're listening to Technically Speaking on WHUS.org 91.7, Yukon's Sound Alternative.
It is licensed under the Mozilla Public License version 2.
Works for me.
Which is a free license. You know, not GPL, which is fine, but it's an open license. That means that people can see the code, change what they want, and use it however they want, which is always great for this kind of service that you want some sort of assured security.
I agree.
So in the case of any of these syncing solutions, and right now I think my recommendation, assuming they're not highly confidential files, is that it would be fine to use something like Dropbox or Google Drive or whatever. What you're going to do with these is you can install them and configure them on the phone, install them and configure them on your laptop, desktop, or whatever other computer you want to use. And then that should make it relatively easy. Just like if you're moving from your laptop to your desktop computer, it should be pretty easy to use that to move the files onto and off of your phone as well. The details will change depending on which particular service you choose to use, but in all cases, they should make that process relatively seamless. And let's move on now. We wanted to talk about a game, actually. This is a board game. We get a little bit geeky with board games now and again, so hopefully you will forgive us as we wander off into the world of gaming. And I have a little write-up here, so I'm going to pass it over to Drew.
All right, so we want to talk to you for a minute about a game called Splendor. Splendor is a multiplayer board game from Space Cowboy, where players are Renaissance gem merchants, where you are buying, transporting gems, and then presumably selling gems at the end. The game features around rather than having a board, it features around a grid of 12 cards that you purchase with gems, their currency of the game, represented by tokens. As the game progresses, you can purchase more and more expensive cards, where you're starting purchasing the mines where the gems are being collected, and then you're purchasing the modes of transportation to get them to the shops, and then finally you're purchasing the shops. Each level of asset being worth more and more victory points, going towards a total number of victory points that the first player to reach gets declared the victor. So Mike, Jason, and I played this for the first time together last weekend, and I'm kind of excited. I was really psyched about this the first time I played it, actually the first 18 or so times I played it before I introduced it to them. So I'm really excited to hear what you guys have to say about it.
You want to go first, Mike?
Sure. I thought it was a pretty cool game. I would like more plays of it to give a better review. We only played it once, but all of us in the room seemed to catch on to it pretty quickly. You know, we were all pretty seasoned board game players, but, you know, we kind of got into the rhythm and it became a pretty competitive game very quickly. So it has that going for it. I think the rules and mechanics are fairly simple, especially if you've played board games before. It's a cool theme. I like the production was very nice. I like all the pieces were fun, and easy to use. And, overall, I'd recommend it someone to try it out. It's probably more on the casual side in terms of board games, which is good if you ask me, you know, more getting more people involved. But if you're into more hardcore, you know, complex strategy, though there is strategy to the game, you know, a fair amount, it's not going to be your most strategic possible game, and plays fairly quickly.
So I was impressed by the game, I have to say. I've been leaning more and more towards board games that that play fairly quickly, particularly if there is some depth and some complexity to it, but not so much that you need to spend an hour and a half doing setup and teaching people how to play, and then you get to play the game, and then it's another 45 minutes per person or something like that. I feel like I have an endless supply of games like that already available to me, and that those games barely ever get played anyway. And I was impressed. It's very simple, very quick to set up, and it plays fairly fluidly. There's a significant amount of player interaction, which is something that I always look for in games. You're competing for limited resources, and you have the ability to make plays based on the information you can see about the players around you that will maybe not significantly hurt your growth or your development, but will significantly impact their development, both by locking out cards that they would like to acquire or by taking certain resources when the timing is correct for you to do so. And I like that. I like that there's some depth and some interaction to it. One of the things that bugs me about some of these economy games is when there isn't enough interaction between the players. And I feel like they just about hit the right space there. The only thing I think would be interesting is if it was possible to directly trade with other players the resources and possibly even the hidden cards. But that might screw up the game in other ways, so I wouldn't want to play around with that until I'd gotten more playthroughs with the basic rules of the game. But I was impressed with it. It's a mix of a sort of a deck-building game, except the deck of cards that you're building is always going to be face-up in front of you and always available for your use, except for certain hidden cards, which I don't need to explain what they're for. It's sort of immaterial. And it's also a set collection game. There's a significant amount of set collection. That's the primary mechanic you're using to get the cards that you're using to build the decks. And it's a race to victory points. And the game very quickly moves from the like, oh, we're still just sort of figuring things out here, to, oh my God, the game's about to end. I have to do something. I have to get more victory points. And I like that sort of pace. I thought the pacing of the game was very solid, especially for a first playthrough when people are still figuring it out. It felt like it developed quickly, and I enjoyed that aspect of the game.
Yeah, so I think if you're looking for something with a similar complexity to Ticket to Ride, not in any way, even in a vaguest sense, similar gameplay, but the same level of complexity in terms of picking it up, something that's fast paced that, you know, only takes you 20 or 30 minutes, Splendor is definitely worth checking out. You can find more about it on their website or by just Googling it.
Is it Splendor D-O-R or D-O-U-R?
S-P-L-E-N-D-O-R.
And their current rating on Board Game Geek, which is the great arbitrator of all things board games, is 7.6. That's actually pretty good for Board Game Geek.
Yeah, solid.
And just for the record, we weren't provided with any compensation for talking about this game. We're just talking about it because we enjoyed playing it.
Yeah, we just like board games. Nobody gives us free games or anything.
If only.
Well, technically speaking, was produced live this week by Drew Gates, Jason McMullen, and Mike Fagan. You can find the podcast at wespeaktech.org or every Monday at 11 a.m. on 91.7 FM WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut and WHUS.org.